Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that has one abiding love, that of cinema. Regardless of theme, tone, or even genre, what we look for in the end is quality. And that's the case even when considering one of the most popular of all genres, the love story. As usual, we'll be discussing three movies during this week's show, and the theme involves love. Yet each of the movies defines that emotion in a different way. The pointedly titled documentary Crip Camp tells the story of how, in the early 1970s, a group of summer campers, each marked by a different kind of disability, first bonded and then became the genesis of a national movement. The Georgian film And Then We Danced focuses on the sexual awakening of a young dancer and the testosterone-heavy Georgian culture. Finally, the comedy The Lovebirds features a couple who, on the verge of breaking up, rediscovers during a madcap farcical misadventure what drew them together in the first place. Let's begin with a trek back to a very special summer camp. From 1951 to 1977, campers with a range of disabilities, everything from polio to cerebral palsy, flocked to Camp Jened, a summer camp located in upstate New York. By the late 60s, the atmosphere at the camp had changed to reflect the counterculture movement that would lead to, among other things, the Woodstock Music Festival. In this new camp environment, a spirit of newfound freedom was born. Instead of merely taking what life had to offer, a nucleus of these campers began to realize that they had the same right of access to public life as anyone else. Their connection and the larger story that would come out of it, one that would ultimately lead to the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act, is what co-directors James Lebrecht and Nicole Noonan document in Crip Camp, a Sundance Film Festival Audience Award winner that reveals a bit of American history that you're not likely to read in many history books.
Dan, as you and I know, we're reading Jill Lepore's These Truths, that book, as part of our quarantine episode, and we discovered that there are many things that we don't know about from history. But yes, the disability rights movement is certainly one of them. And I think that the people who attended the so-called Crip Camp in the early 1970s, at least when much of the archival footage comes from, probably realized that they were doing something groundbreaking personally, but not necessarily the national and wider spread effect that this meeting of people would lead to ultimately. Because this camp had existed in upstate New York for 25 years when these folks happened to go there in the summer of 1972. The whole notion of kids being able to escape from the city has been a longtime New York tradition. The fact that these kids happen to have physical disabilities, at least, is the unusual feature here. And the film opens by presenting this group of campers who have their first sexual experiences while at this camp, who have their first opportunity to commune with others who are similarly situated and have frank and open discussions. It's truly amazing that we get to observe them as outsiders, because indeed they're talking about things that are very personal and unique to their circumstances. And one of them struck me when the group of campers talks about the fact that they have very little privacy because their parents are the quintessential, in many cases, helicopter parents and won't let them do anything on their own. They're also at the behest of their siblings and so forth. It documents the fact that at least for this group of individuals, they were not permitted in many instances to attend public schools. And then when they were able to go to school, they were put into special education classes, which were not meant or geared for individuals with physical disabilities.
Separate but equal.
Yes, that's been a mantra that we've had in the U.S. forever and ever and ever. So what's the high point of this documentary? I think it's, as you said, Dan, learning about the history of the disability rights movement, because the camp setting is only the beginning for what we see subsequently. And it's the fact that people who had their individual consciousness sort of heightened were able to come together and maintain this contact with one another, you know, in some instances for a lifelong period. And at least three or four of the people, including the director or co-director himself,
James Lebrecht,
yes, who attended the camp and has a physical disability, he remained active in the disability rights movement probably through the present time. But the most notable character from this entire movie, I think, is a woman, Judy Heuermann, who became a national and international figure in this movement, including being the person who led the sit-in at the federal building in San Francisco, protesting the fact that the Health and Human Services director, or HEW director at the time, Joseph Califano, on Carter's watch, refused to implement the regulations of Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. So we learn a lot of information, but it ultimately is the relationships and the empowerment that people get from one another. And these campers who were exposed to things that they knew nothing about that fuels the movement subsequently.
Yeah, and I think this film, Crip Camp, which we should mention is streaming on Netflix right now, so you can watch it as soon as the show is over, which I recommend you do. It's really a film in two parts, because the first part of this story is about how all of these people found their voices and found their personalities at this camp because they were surrounded by people who didn't question their disabilities, who didn't do double takes at them, who allowed them to develop friendships and romances and other relationships that the outside world seemingly wouldn't allow them to have because they were seen as different. And as you said, you know, even when they were finally able to go to public schools, they were usually put in the basement or hidden away and not able to interact with people that didn't have disabilities. And then the second part of this story is about how that environment at Camp Jened and the experiences that the people had there really changed them. And so that this camp, you know, kind of tucked away in the Catskills, became a flashpoint for a civil rights movement that, I mean, as you said, I mean, I didn't know much about this either until I saw this film. It's actually kind of crazy how little we're taught about this movement that happened. And so I think that it's a pretty powerful look at these people who were taught for so much of their lives to not draw attention to themselves, either by, you know, their family units or even just out of self-preservation. They were given the confidence to basically go scream in the public square about these very real injustices and to become the face of this movement. And the fact that we have so much great archival footage, both from the people that participated and just, you know, news crews from the time, I think adds a lot to the film.
And I think the one thing that this film does, I mean, having been a Crip Camp, having been a counselor during the same time period in the Adirondacks in New York, it just shows you, Nathan, as you point out, that this is a regular camp. Campers may not be engaging in the exact color war activities of campers at nearby locations, but everything else felt really authentic, especially those conversations that the campers were having among themselves.
Yeah, and there's a moment during one of those conversations where a girl with cerebral palsy, with severe cerebral palsy, is trying to express herself and no one can understand what she's saying. And the documentarian that's leading this conversation goes around the table and says, did anybody get that? And then there's another kid there also with CP, but who can communicate a little more clearly, says, I think I understand what she means. And he relays the information. And she says, yes, that's what I was trying to say. And it's this really powerful moment of somebody who has not been understood or listened to being understood and listened to. And to see that in real time, you know, with these real people is an astonishing thing to see.
Yeah, that's the moment that I teared up when I watched this, because it was an amazing moment. And you've both touched on one of the powerful things about that Camp Jened that led over to the national movement is that they weren't condescended to and they didn't condescend to each other. You see kids in wheelchairs having to hit a softball and play softball and be wheeled to first base and get thrown out. You know, I mean, it was, here's life, let's live it. And
they're making fun of each other too, the way
exactly.
that all right, kids do.
And they also take on the issue of the whole hierarchy of disabilities, because and that's a tough subject to address. And I think I've mentioned on this program previously, there's a South Park episode that deals with it, but typically it's something that's not discussed. Yeah. But
the polios are at the top and what the CPs are at the bottom.
That's what they say. Right. Yeah.
And so I found this to be a fascinating documentary. I would say that the title of the film tells only part of the story, as you indicated, Nathan, but it's well worth watching. And even for someone such as myself, who thought she knew a lot about the disability rights movement in the US and abroad, was constantly reminded of things I did not know. So definitely a watch.
And that was CripCamp. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at And Then We Danced and The Lovebirds. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Dan Pertini, current board member and longtime sustaining member of Spokane Public Radio. In my life, the news, music, and culture is important. Public radio brings the world to my car and to my living room. And it also takes the voices and talents of the Northwest to national venues. Through public radio, we all take part in and remain in the know about issues in our area, our state, the nation, and the world. That's why I'm here, and that's why I am a supporter. So perhaps you might ask yourself why you listen to public radio. Think it over. And then please give a little back to help Spokane Public Radio keep going. And thank you for your support.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the documentary Crip Camp. Let's now move to And Then We Danced in the Lovebirds. And let's begin by heading not to the state of Georgia, but to the country of Georgia, which once was part of what used to be called the Soviet Union. We've seen the story before. A guy in a group, in this case a dance troupe, has ambitions to move up in the world. But then a new guy shows up and suddenly our protagonist feels threatened. His feelings, though, are complicated. And pretty soon it becomes clear that they are really complicated, because they reveal to him a side of his sexuality that he's been keeping under wraps, even from himself. And why not? Particularly in a masculine-laced world, even among dancers, where anything resembling same-sex love is seen as not just an abomination, but as an insult to the very country itself. Georgian dance is based on masculinity, we're told. There is no room for weakness. But despite its familiarity, And Then We Danced feels fresh for its unique setting, and especially whenever Levon Galbakiani, an actor-dancer that the camera loves, steps into the frame.
Before we talk about the merits of this film, And Then We Danced, which I think there are many merits to it, just a little brief background about the film itself. When it was released in its native country of Georgia last year, it actually inspired a lot of controversy and protests. Some conservative groups threatened to basically cancel screenings or disrupt screenings. The Georgian Orthodox Church actually disapproved of the film itself. The Ministry of Internal Affairs of Georgia actually posted troops outside of theaters that were showing this in the major cities because they were concerned about protests and violence. And violence did break out and some people were arrested. I don't think anybody was seriously injured, but this is a movie that has been a real flashpoint of controversy in its native country. And so it's interesting to read that and then see the movie, because the movie itself is so sweet and humane and open-hearted and not explicit at all in any way. And I think I referenced the film Call Me By Your Name last week or the week before when we were talking about Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And I think the parallels to that film are even louder here. I mean, there's so many similarities with the first half of And Then We Dance and the first half of Call Me By Your Name. Even the looks of the characters, you sort of have this lanky guy with floppy hair and then kind of the more traditionally handsome square-jawed guy, just like Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer in that film. And then just sort of the way that they kind of glance at each other, and then that leads to sort of these passing touches, and then that eventually spills over into just outright physicality. I mean, it's the way that both of these movies deal with that, I think, is really great. There's even an extended sequence on this idyllic country estate, which reminded me of Call Me By Your Name, but I think they're mostly coincidental here. I don't even know if the country of Georgia got the movie Call Me By Your Name. It's possible this filmmaker never even saw it. But I think it's the second half of And Then We Dance where it becomes its own thing and it becomes a totally different story. And it all culminates in this final dance number, because we see these characters dancing and sort of expressing desire and communicating with one another through this traditional dance of Georgia. And then at the end, when our lead character has this big audition, it's almost like Flashdance. Remember how she had to go into that big room with all of the judges and audition? It's kind of like that. But we see everything that's happened to him over the course of the film kind of explode and come out in this final dance number, where he's taking these traditional Georgian dance moves and sort of turning them on their head, literally and figuratively in some cases. So I thought this was really terrific. And, you know, just the way that it uses dance and the power of bodies moving in harmony to be a really beautiful one. So this is kind of one of those hidden gems you come across every once in a while that I think is very much worth seeing.
I agree, because our initial sort of reaction is, oh, been there, done that. And that's true up to a point. And Then We Danced tells us about sort of the struggles of the former Soviet republics. And Georgia's history is somewhat unique, because we are more familiar with Eastern European countries that have sort of broken free from the Soviet orbit to a greater extent. And so that tension is always in the background. We can see how these people's lives have been affected by the transition from communist times to the present. There's this whole backstory involving Marab's family, because obviously his family had been involved in the dancing world in Georgia for multiple generations. And we don't know exactly what happened to the parents, to the grandparents, and so forth. But we can imagine that they had run afoul of the powers that be in various ways. The real star of this film is the primary character, but that's not to in any way diminish the contributions of the secondary characters. And I really appreciated the young woman who plays Marab's partner. She's been his dance partner since childhood, since they were 10 years old. And everyone assumes that they're going to have this love relationship. And instead, they have just a really, really deep friendship. But I think with the estate, with the notion of the hierarchy, the political and other hierarchy of what's happening there, we do get a glimpse into Georgian society. And it's a country with which many of us have limited familiarity. I mean, we know a little bit about it because a friend of and colleague of mine had a Fulbright scholarship there. So we
in Tbilisi, yeah.
Yeah, so we have some awareness, but I really thought this did a great job on multiple levels.
Yeah, and the only thing that I would add to that is that it's always a pleasure when you find films from small, lightly regarded countries such as Georgia, and they boast filmmakers and people like Levan Galbakiani, who would make it in any film anywhere because they just have talent. At any rate, that was And Then We Danced. Let's close with The Lovebirds. If And Then We Danced boasts a familiar plotline, then The Lovebirds feels almost like plagiarism. In the midst of a breakup, a couple played by Kumail Nanjiani and Issa Rae get mistakenly mixed up in a murder which has them running for their lives. One stupid decision after the next takes them all over New Orleans, traveling around courtesy of different Lyft drivers. Product placement, anyone? One scene in a theater might even have been lifted from Stanley Kubrick's final film, 1999's Eyes Wide Shut. So, no, little about The Lovebirds feels original. Still, Nanjiani, the stand-up comic who earned fame courtesy of the HBO series Silicon Valley, and who was so good in 2017's The Big Sick, is always good for a laugh, as is Ray, the actress and producer best known for starring in The Romance, The Photograph, and the HBO series Insecure. The two might not make for the most predictable of romantic couples, but they do have both a good on-screen chemistry and a skillful way with wisecracks.
I thought that Lovebirds or The Lovebirds was something that I needed to watch right now, because we have been watching, you know, a lot of serious films and, of course, our usual police procedural series from Europe. But I got a kick out of this film because I was not really that familiar with Issa Rae, except for her turn in The Photograph most recently. So then I went back and binge watched Insecure. And it's clear that this woman is really a major talent in certainly writing, directing, and so forth. I don't know if this was the best vehicle, but it does address some serious issues in various ways against this sort of backdrop of this sort of silly story. And so I liked many things about it. I laughed multiple times. This might not be the right anecdote for everyone at this particular point, but anything that's a so-called dark comedy has my attention during this quarantine period.
Well, I love Kumail Nanjiani. I love Issa Rae. I loved The Big Sick, which was the last movie that Kumail Nanjiani and director Michael Showalter collaborated on. I didn't care for this very much. It has so many scenes that seem like they're going to go somewhere and take off in a farcical kind of screwball direction. And then they just kind of fizzle out and end. It's like they thought, oh, we'll just put Issa and Kumail on camera and they'll improv something funny. And it didn't really happen this time. I would like to see them together again, just in a script that's more fully formed, because this ain't it.
No, I totally agree with you. But as Mary Pat pointed out, any port in a storm during the quarantine. So
yeah, but there's a lot of better ports that you can pull into than this one.
I agree.
Okay.
Maybe we'll have them in future weeks. And that was The Lovebirds. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbend and Murray Pat Truthart and I discussed And Then We Danced and Crip Camp. Let's take this moment to thank Pete Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, remember this thought, paraphrased from the great Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. People see in the world what they carry in their heart. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.